So today we continue our series that we're doing through the beginning, the first nine kind of chapters of Genesis, actually probably closer to 11, where we're going back at looking at some of these incredible stories and the timeless truths that are contained within them. And I say this again just as a reminder, or maybe you're with us here for the first time, if you are, welcome, that we recognize that these early chapters of Genesis can be a contentious issue for some Christians, even between some Christians. People bring their various interpretations to the text, and even the person sitting next to you might have a different one to your own. And so our goal isn't to kind of engage in this debate. Our goal through this series, in fact, to be honest, a sermon is not the best context to engage in such a debate. I get to speak and apparently you don't, you know. But nevertheless, what we do want to do is we want to engage some of the timeless truths, some of these things that are contained within these stories that we just don't want to miss, because regardless of your hermeneutic, your way of interpreting scripture, it is there. And the same is true today as we look at the story classically referred to as Noah's Ark. So just a reminder, this series is not about embracing or promoting a specific hermeneutic or a way of interpreting the Bible. This is about embracing and seeking timeless revelation and timeless truth. And here we have the story of Noah. You'll notice that in our banner that we have along here, that's it, you know where it is, mate. Along here, as we look at the meta-narrative of Scripture, we see, there it is, about five, six panels across, the story of Noah's Ark. And as you look at it, you might even look and kind of go, gee, it's a bit of a mixed bag, isn't it? We've got some people, kind of, there's God up there in the top left, the triune God. We've kind of got the boat with the rainbow, which we'll get to later. We've got some people who seem to be alive there on the left outside of one. And then there's a whole lot of people crossed out there in the waters. Now, when you look at this picture, and particularly as adults, we look at this story, and I kind of find it perplexing that this is one of the classic stories we tell kids, right? Mostly because of all those crossed out people down in the blue section there. But at the same time, it also doesn't surprise me because, you know, it wasn't that long ago we went to the local library had a little kind of, you know, I suppose, kind of sale of anything that they didn't want. We picked up this CD, which had some kind of classic kids' rhymes and songs, and we stuck it in our CD player as we were in our car, and we start listening to some of these songs, and we realize how disturbing some of these songs are. That, you know, I'm being swallowed by a boa constrictor was the basis of one of these songs. And, and if you know any of these kids' kind of songs, like, we know, we're like, what are we feeding our kids? But nevertheless, right, there is something profound about this story that we want to celebrate, and it's worth acknowledging that this is a messy story. It's a messy story. It has animals, and they're all pretty because there's two of each and all that jazz, but it is a messy story, but there is a line, in fact, multiple lines of grace that run through this story that I definitely want to highlight today. So it also spans three chapters. So we're just going to be engaging a little bit in the story. If you haven't had the opportunity to read this for yourself, I genuinely encourage you to over the course of this next week. But we're going to start here at Genesis chapter 6, verses 5 to 8, just to give a bit of context as to what is happening. The Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. Pretty big slam, right? Pretty big slam. The Lord regretted that he had made human beings on the earth, and his heart was deeply troubled. So the Lord said, I will wipe from the face of the earth the human race I've created, and with them the animals, the birds, and the creatures that move along the ground, for I regret that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. So again, it's a very strange positioning of this story because, as you would be aware, the previous chapters, what do we know about creation? It's good. It's good. It's very good. Creation is loaded with potential. Like we see, yes, we see the fall, and we'll talk about it in a moment, but it's, again, God has made this good creation. So you've got to ask the question then, why so suddenly is he about to destroy that which is good? And yet what we see here from these early verses is that that sin that was referred to these last couple of weeks, first by Simon and then by Scott, this little sin, this little objection, this little deviation from God's ideal had grown and had a trajectory that was further and further away from the shalom, the wholeness that God intended for his creation, to the point where it's described that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. Can you hear the emphasis? It's like double emphasis. Like, this is bad and bad. And God is essentially looking at this good earth that he made, this very good people that he made, and saying things cannot remain as they are. Because the trajectory, right, if we think about it this way, the trajectory of where the earth is going will not ever come back around. It's only moving away from what I intended. Now, you might look at this and a bunch, particularly with a Western logical mindset, a bunch of questions kind of come to mind about the ethics of God's particular action. And I've seen people who try to justify this and unnecessarily address, often poorly, various kind of rationale for God justifying this particular behavior. But actually what I want to do is, rather than kind of engage in that debate, I want to ask the question, what are we actually looking at here with this story? Because when we actually ask the question, what are we looking at from a literary perspective, a lot of those debates and a lot of those controversies actually fade away into meaninglessness. And so I'm going to introduce to you a few ideas today that I recognize might kind of take you by surprise. They might be a little bit deep, but I promise you, if you go with me, you will discover that there is incredible truth here that I hope you never miss again. The first thing to recognize, and again, I recognize this might take a few people by surprise, is that there were many other flood stories that existed within the people groups that predate the writings of Noah's Ark. This is one. This is the Epic of Atrasis, or the Epic of Gilgamesh, as later it turned into. You can see it's actually written on stone in a version called Sumer writing. So the writings of Noah's Ark were actually only written on a parchment, like 1,000 years later. So this is actually a story that technically predates Noah's Ark between 800 and 1,000 years. What we're not talking about here is the history of the story. We're talking about when it was written, okay? So again, this is not the controversy about when this happened. All we're saying is that there were stories about floods that pre-existed the stories of Noah's Ark and that were actually circulating at the time. Now, some people say that this is part of a historical cultural memory. The fact that there are multiple cultures that all have these flood stories, right, suggests that it could absolutely have been a historic event. And they're all trying to make sense of this flood, make sense of this experience, but they're all trying to do it in their own unique way. Now, in the Epic of Troasis, there is a pantheon of gods. There is multiple gods, and they look at their deceitful human population and they decide to cull them. Okay, what had happened was the humans in their story were supposed to work the earth, and then the humans were a bit lazy, and so then the demigods had to work the earth, and they weren't very happy about that. So because the gods had to then work the earth, they're like, let's just cull the humans because they're no good to us. So that's the basis of this flood story. They were just going to eliminate people because they were useless. They were no good to the gods. You see how this is a little bit different to the narrative that we've got in Noah's Ark. Now, the hero, Atrasis, was warned by one of the gods that this flood was coming, the deluge, they would call it. And so he built a raft, okay, a raft. And he took two of everything. Sound familiar? Two animals, two seeds as well. And he survived this flood and later was deified, turned into a god as a reward. Different story, okay? We're not talking about Noah's Ark here, right? But you can see how these stories have some similarities. So the question is, if this was one of the stories and a significant story that was circulating at the time, what then is unique about Noah's Ark? What is unique about the Hebrew story that points us toward the uniqueness of our God, right? This is the question we need to ask. Now, again, even just that little bit of revelation, some people might be like, oh, don't worry. Okay, this doesn't scare me and it shouldn't scare you, okay? The idea of adapting existing stories for the purpose of exposing truth was a common literary practice. Paul did it in Athens in the New Testament, where he quotes the pagan prophets. Okay, this is not new. okay? It is very common in Christian tradition to take something that was and reappropriate it for the purposes of pointing people to Yahweh or to Jesus, okay? Very common. It just might surprise you that it was happening way back then too, all right? So don't freak out. Have fun exploring this, and it no way diminishes the authority of Scripture, okay? But we ask the question, what makes this biblical story unique against the other stories that were circulating at the same time? So again, this is going to feel a little academic for some. But if we don't go there, we actually miss the heart of this story. We end up just talking about animals, and that's all good. But for other people today, this is actually going to trigger a level of wonder of the Scriptures that I actually believe that some of you are looking for. There is so much going on here. So let's continue. Verse 9, and then skipping to 12 to 14. This is the account of Noah and his family. Noah was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time, and he walked faithfully with God. Continuing on, God saw how corrupt the earth had become, for all the people on earth had corrupted their ways. So God said to Noah, I am going to put an end to all people, for the earth is filled with violence because of them. I am surely going to destroy both them and the earth. So make yourself an ark of cypress wood. And then the story continues. He builds the ark, he collects the animals, and so on and so forth. It goes on for three chapters. Now, this story was written a particular way. Some of you guys, maybe in primary school, learnt the idea of an acrostic poem, right? This is where it's like the first line starts with A, the second line starts with B, the third line starts with C, you know. And we look at that, and when we look at it on a page, we look and we go, A, B, C, I see what they're doing there, right? We see and we note how something is written. Well, the same was true in the old writings as well, the ancient writings. They did use acrostics. The Book of Lamentations is an example of that. Hebrews. Every Hebrew letter starts with the next letter in the alphabet. But here, in the story of Noah's Ark, we have what is called a chiastic structure. And this shouldn't surprise you, because if you read this story, you'll notice there's a lot of repetition, because there has to be. Because in order for a chiasm to work, you need two of each, except right in the middle. And so as you read through this story, you'll note that there is a parallel passage on each side of this story. You can see Noah and his sons, for example, in 6:10 in A, and all the way down in 9:19, Noah and his sons. And it works all its way toward the middle. This is really deliberate. And in case you think I'm just making this up as well, you can note special numbers. The numbers 7, 40, and 150 also form a little chiasm in the middle of this story too. It all points toward the center. It is a deliberate thing, right, that we don't see unless we're specifically noting it, right? But something that is very, very common in a lot of Old Testament writings. It's awesome, right? Because in the same way that we look at an acrostic and I say, I know what you're doing there, we can look at a chiasm or a chiastic structure and we can say, I know what you're doing there. Because the chiasm is very deliberate in pointing to the middle. This is the key. Everything is building toward the middle, right, of this story. And whatever is in the middle there is the gold. That is the thing that the author especially wants you to note. It's like all this other stuff is good and maybe there's some detail in this, but it's all leading to one particular point. And if you follow that all the way into the middle, you find that at chapter 8, verse 1, remembering that there weren't chapters and verses back when this was written, okay? So it all leads toward the treasure in the middle, and that's what I want to focus on today. Because that is what the writer of this story wanted us to focus on too. And this is what it says. In the middle of this grand story that spans three chapters, this right here, when we ask the question, how is this story unique from the other stories that were circulating at the time? This is the crux. But God remembered Noah and all the wild animals and the livestock that were with him in the ark. And he sent a wind over the earth and the waters receded. So why? Why is this the treasure? Why is this the thing that's right there in the middle? Why is this the thing that the author wanted to point to all the way through in this structure? What does this particular verse say about Yahweh that it doesn't say, or in comparison to the other God myths at the time? And I want to just point out a couple of things here. The first thing, it notes that God remembered Noah. So in case you're not kind of familiar with the story. He builds this ark and gets all the animals, sets of two except for the clean animals. He gets some extras of those. And then the floods come and everything gets covered in water. And then they spend ages on the water. And they're just sitting there. And you've got to ask, when you're sitting in a boat for 40 days, which is a number of completion, by the way, it's this sense of like you're sitting there going, God, you realize we're still up here, right? It's like, you know, like you get this picture of like if everything else has been covered, if everything else has been destroyed, and you're sitting there in the one vessel of safety, there's something that might cross your mind of being kind of like, you know, I'm here, right? It's always like that moment when after church and then like one kid was kind of left behind because parents each thought that the other parent was taking them, and then everyone else leaves the church and you're kind of left here with the one kid and they're going, did my parents remember me? Happens. And you kind of get this sense of like, will they remember? Yes, they'll remember as soon as they get home. Where's, great, all right. So, but this is a God who remembers. And this is a regular refrain throughout the Old Testament, right? The God remembered his people, right? This shouldn't take us by surprise. Remember, remember, remember. Now, this is important to recognize. That doesn't mean that God had previously forgotten. That's how we process remember. I forgot that, now I remembered, okay? That's not what this word is suggesting in the Hebrew. Rather, it is a statement of contrast compared to the gods who would forget, who intended to forget, who intended to destroy all human beings because they were useless, had no worth, they were not very good. Okay? This was a point of contrast for the gods whose primary orientation was toward themselves and their needs rather than the God of Israel, Yahweh, right, whose primary orientation was toward his people. You see, in the Sumerian myth story, man was only saved through deception. That was the only reason they survived, deception. And yet here in this story, God remembers. God is orientated and positioned toward people. And for me, I know that this is profound because sometimes we go through things in life and we can go through incredible trauma or through seasons of ill health or whatever it might be. And we sometimes can't see the end, right? And we can feel like we're sitting up there in the boat and we're going, you've saved me, God, but why? Because I'm just kind of sitting here. Are you going to reach out? Are you actually going to do something? Are you going to remember me? And I know I've had those moments in my life and I've sat with people in the midst of their pain who have been in those times. And yet, God is the God who remembers. This story reminds us of the character of Yahweh, who is one who does not forget. He will not give up on us. He will not give up on you. You may have felt forgotten, but God will remember. And I did this when we talked about the Genesis narrative as well. Think about how significant that truth it is if that actual truth resides within you. Think about how significant it is in comparison to the God who wants you dead, who doesn't care, the God who for whom you're only alive because you got away with it, as opposed to the God who remembers and is there and remembers. Let's continue in this crux. But God remembered Noah and all the wild animals and the livestock that were with him in the ark, and he sent a wind over the earth and the waters receded. A wind over the earth. Can anyone tell me the last time you heard about a wind hovering over some waters? Genesis 1 verse 2. That's right. The Spirit hovered over the waters. Okay. So right here, in the crux of the story, in the midst of destruction and devastation, what do we have? We have an echo of Genesis 1 verse 2. We're right from the beginning, in the midst of the tohu vavohu, the wild and waste, God is hovering by his Spirit over the waters, about to bring about what? Creation. Yeah, okay. So right here, in the midst of devastation, we have a reference to the God who is breathing back over those waters and is about to recreate. Recreate, not something that is bad, but recreate something that is good. God is in the restoration business. God is in the recreation business. And you and I both know that there are times in our lives where God needs to take things away that have become destructive, right? This is a big part of the story of Noah. But our God knows when to stop. Our God knows when to stop destroying. He knows when to stop refining so that he can recreate and so that he can send that wind, that spirit. Same word, ruah, that wind spirit over the water and to recreate in us once again. And I know for me, this particular reference helps me make sense of why in this particular story, God would destroy all that he called good, right? Because it wasn't destroy for the sake of destruction, and it wasn't actually destroying to the point of absolute completion. It was always the process of significant, I acknowledge, refining for the purpose of recreation. This is the heart of our God, the God who is in the business of recreation. And we know sometimes there has to be a loss before recreation can occur. There needs to be some death before life can occur, lest we look at the cross. This is the story of our God. And lastly, it notes that the water has receded, and I just want to pick up on that because of where that follows on, which is the process of rebuilding. The waters had to recede for the process of rebuilding to occur. And this is something else that is true about our God. God will work with a remnant. He will work with a few. And God will take a remnant, and it won't always be pretty, but in the end, he will produce something beautiful. And of course, this is echoed in the New Testament. In John chapter 15, where Jesus talks about the vine and the branches, and he says, you know, abide in me. And then he talks about pruning. The things that are unuseful are going to be cut off, but even those things that produce good fruit will also be pruned, that there will be even greater growth. There is a sense in which God recognizes that things need to be cut back in order for new life to emerge. And so in this case, what does God leave? He leaves the righteous. And even that righteous man that we notice in Noah would be flawed, as we discover in the following chapters. And yet God is willing to work with a remnant, and he did here, and he would again in the story of Israel, in exile, and then in Exodus over and over again. God is willing to work with a remnant. And again, it may be that you feel a little bit like a remnant in your workplace, in your family even, right? Maybe some really tough stuff has gone down, and we're not necessarily attributing that to the action of God. Sometimes life is just broken and things happen, but sometimes we can feel like we are the remnant. We are the one who is left. And we ask the question, is it only me? Am I the last one? Echoing the words of Elijah in the desert. I'm the last one here. He wasn't, by the way. There were 7,000 others. But we ask this question and we feel in that moment that we are alone, and God's truth, the truth about Yahweh that comes again through this story, is God is willing to use the remnant, even if that is flawed. And so right here in chapter 8, verse 1, right at that crux and that center of the chiasm, we have these profound truths that stand in contrast to the Sumerian story and to the Mesopotamian flood narratives. It's that God always remembers his people. God is in the business of recreation. Bringing that wind over that waters. And God will work with a remnant. I wonder for you whether you have felt or are feeling right now a little bit alone. Maybe you have someone in your world who is feeling isolated right now, like some devastation has occurred around them. And the question is, do they know of the God who remembers and the God who recreates and the God who works with a remnant? I didn't even realize that they all started with R, but isn't that great? So, you know, these are the questions that we need to ask ourselves. But we have to talk about the rainbow, don't we? It's Noah's Ark after all. And God said, in light of this story, this is the sign of the covenant I'm making between you and every living creature with you, a covenant for all generations to come. I have set my rainbow, we'll talk about it later, in the clouds, and it will be the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. Whenever I bring clouds over the earth and the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will remember my covenant between me and you and all living creatures of every kind. Never again will the waters become a flood to destroy all life. Whenever the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and all living creatures of every kind on the earth. Now again, if you notice some repetition there, you're like, didn't he already say that? It's because it's a chiasm, right? You're going to get two copies, right? There is it, all over this thing, okay? But at the same time, there is some incredibly profound things that are going on here with this sign that God holds. And again, I'm going to introduce you to one more thing that might blow your mind, but go with me on this. Something called a suzerain vassal covenant. And the thing is, I have to share this with you because if I don't, I'm not doing integrity to what's going on here, right? I don't share this because I want you to be just academically astute. I just cannot not share this. Now, suzerain vassal covenants occurred in the ancient Near East at the time. And these covenants existed between the suzerain, which was the powerful party, strong party, and the vassal, which was the weaker party, right? And essentially, these agreements existed so that one, the suzerain, didn't just wipe out the vassal, right? Because that's what they could have done. If they had military might, strength, resource, they could just wipe out the weaker vassal. But instead, some chose to establish a covenant. And the suzerain would be the powerful party, and then there'll be the vassal, which is the weaker party. And again, you'll see another one of these when God makes a commitment to Abraham, and they make a covenant. And again, if you know the splitting of the animal and walking through, this was a suzerain vassal covenant. Now, what usually happens is that as the vassal, as the weaker party, you will get a sign of that covenant, which is a bit like a receipt, right? I've got evidence that you are not going to kill me, suzerain, right? I've got the evidence right here. Okay, circumcision, the sign, yeah? Making the connections in the Old Testament. It was designed to prove that the covenant existed, all right? I throw these things out just to kind of make sense of a bunch of stuff that you've probably been holding for a while, okay? Now, again, usually the vassal, the weaker party, has to hold the sign. They're the one who has to have the receipt. If they can't present the receipt of the covenant, then they are in danger. But what does God say? Even though he is the suzerain, even though he is the powerful one in this covenant, he says, I will keep the sign. God says, I will hold the sign. I will place the sign of the bow within the clouds so you don't have to. Oh, man, the grace of God, right? The God who's just like, look how you've stuffed up the world, man. You can't deal with that. How are you going to hold on to a sign? And God's just like, I'm the suzerain. I'm the powerful one here. You're supposed to keep this. I'll keep the sign. And whenever I place this bow in the clouds, you'll be reminded of the sign. And we'll be reminded of the covenant. And you'll be reminded that even though I have the power to destroy, I am for you. Whoa, okay, let's not just talk about Jesus and grace. This is grace from the beginning of our God. Over and over and over again. Okay, one more thing. For some of you, this is going to be like, Gavin, nah, you've gone too far. But for some of you, you'll love this. Now, for us, particularly in Western countries, we don't always appreciate art and sign the way that perhaps even our Indigenous brothers and sisters do. Now, the word here in the Hebrew text, rainbow, we actually add the word rain in front of it. The word there is just bow. I will place the bow in the clouds. So when we talk about a bow, what does that remind us of? It's a bow. So for the people of the day, they would have been familiar with bows. All right, so the bow is in the clouds, okay? I love this. Some people would just be like, Gavin, you're on too far. But believe me, this is what would have been seen, right, for the people at the day when you think about images. Now, notice which way the bow is pointing. Which way is the bow pointing? Is it downward? It's the bow in the cloud. Now, again, you might be like, Gavin, that's science. That's the shape of the earth. It has to be that way. But God chose the sign, right? Yeah, he chose the sign. He knew what he was doing. When you think about an arrow, don't worry, I kept it safe. And you think about the sign that God was holding. The bow isn't pointing down to the people like a threat, like you'd expect from the suzerain, right? The bow is pointing toward him. It's pointing toward him. And so when these people just come, the bow, and they're looking at the bow, and that they see the bow, which they're familiar with, because the bow is a weapon, it is a threat, and they see where it is pointing, does that not speak something about the nature of our God? This is a God who places himself at risk for the sake of his creation. He places himself at risk for the sake of his creation. Now, you might be like, Gavin, that's gone too far. That doesn't process. Believe me, I reckon this will resonate with our Indigenous brothers and sisters. They'll see this, okay? This is a God who places himself at risk for the sake of his creation. And we will see this over and over and over again. When Moses strikes the rock, God is standing between. Jesus on the cross, for crying out loud, right? This is a God who places himself at risk for the sake of his creation, and this began all the way back in Genesis. It has not changed. And I want to wrap it up with this. So Noah came out together with his sons and his wife and his sons' wives, all the animals and all the creatures that move along the ground and all the birds, everything that moves on land came out of the ark, one kind after another. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord, and taking some of all the clean animals and clean birds, he sacrificed burnt offerings on it. The Lord smelt the pleasing aroma and said in his heart, "Never again will I curse the ground because of humans, even though every inclination of the human heart is evil from childhood, and never again will I destroy all living creatures as I have done." Now, we love a story with a beautiful resolution, don't we? But let's think about this story for a second. Nothing has changed. The human heart is still evil. The flood has happened, and God acknowledges the human heart is still evil. Nothing has changed except our understanding of who God is. That is the power of this story. That our God engaged his world, and yet from the start to beginning, it's part of that chiasm, nothing has changed. The human heart is still evil. And yet our perspective of the God who remembers and the God who recreates and the God who uses the remnant and the God who places himself at risk for the sake of his creation, our perspective on God has changed. And can you imagine how revolutionary that would be for a people who are trying to discover who this God is? The God who appears to want to destroy creation is simultaneously trying to save it from itself. And even in destruction, God is still committed to his people. Even though every inclination of the human heart is evil, I will not destroy everything, for my justice will not exceed my love. Let me pray. Jesus, we have engaged in a story that is familiar to us, but maybe in a fresh way. And I'm super aware that maybe some of these ideas are new and confronting. I just want to pray that we would just sit in that space where you want to reveal to us your character, your heart. And we want to thank you for your grace that was so evident all the way from the beginning. So I mentioned making the animal skins instead of the fig leaves, and even Scott last week talking about the sign he placed on Cain to avoid his own being killed. And so Jesus, Lord, we repent of those times when we think that your grace is only about Jesus, even though that is the fulfillment, God, but we see your grace from the beginning. And so, God, when we see a rainbow, would we be reminded of you as the God who puts yourself at risk for the sake of creation? God, if we're feeling lonely and isolated, I pray that you would do a work in our hearts to know that we are not alone, that you are for us, that you remember. And God, maybe there is someone in our world that we need to share this message with. Maybe it's a kid. We talk about the heart of this story, or maybe it's a friend who has a different picture of God and just can't reconcile this story with that picture. But God, I just want to pray that you would do a work in our hearts and remind us of who you are. In Jesus' name.